This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
You're in the sweet spot, baby. You're in the sweet spot, girl. You're in the sweet spot, darling. It's a magical kingdom in a mixed up world. You're in the sweet spot, baby. You're in the sweet spot, girl. You're in the sweet spot, darling. It's a magical kingdom in a mixed up world.
Welcome to the Sweet Spot Podcast. My name is Lynn, your host, and Ken's my co-host. Ken, what's going on?
Lynn, it is going. It is going. I am so happy to be here for this episode of the Sweet Spot.
Ken and I are former Disneyland custodial cast members, and we host the number one Disneyland podcast hosted by two former Disneyland custodial cast members.
Number one.
We are also authors of the book, Cleaning the Kingdom. We have two volumes out, and you can get them signed on our website at thesweetspot.com. You can get them on Amazon that are not signed, and you can also get them on digital through Kindle or wherever digital books are found. You can also get them on audio as audiobooks, and you can get those on Audible or wherever audiobooks are found. We also have a Patreon if you want to help support the show. We'd really appreciate it. And we have a couple cool perks that go along with that. One of them is you get to join us for our current events recording. As we record it, you get to be in the chat room listening as we record and then chiming in with in the chat room with other Sweet Spot listeners. So it's a lot of fun. And that we do that once a month. And then you also get one bonus episode delivered to you. And that is for Patreons for $5 or more per month. You can sign up on our website at thesweetspot.com or search Patreon. Go to Patreon and search The Sweet Spot. All right. Ken. Oh, I have one other thing. I wanted to mention I have a new podcast that I'm hosting with Annie from Concierge, and it's a concierge podcast, and it's called Ears to the Kingdom. And they're shorter episodes. We're doing two a month. And it's probably not for people that know the resorts really well. But we're on Disneyland right now. We're kind of talking about the hotels and doing an overview of what they offer. But then we will be moving on to Disney World and other locations like Disney Cruises. And we talk about promotions going on. So if you just want to know what the latest is in the Disney travel, you can check that out. You can search Ears to the Kingdom.
And if you really aren't that familiar with Disneyland yet, you're just maybe starting to learn. We did an episode a little while back. It's episode number 367, if you want to look for that. Kind of introduce you to Disneyland history. Give you kind of an overview of Disneyland history and who we are so that you're all caught up.
Yeah, that was a fun episode too.
That was episode 367. So what's this episode, Lynn?
This episode is 370.
370.
Yep.
That's quite impressive. That's way to go, Lynn. Good going.
Thank you. Yeah. You too. Anyway. So for episode 370, who is our guest?
Well, we have Dave Boffert. We've had him on the podcast before, and we're having him back because there's a new book out on the House of the Future that used to be at Disneyland, and he has brought that to the world. So we're having him on so we can talk about that and pick his brain about the house of the future.
Looking to book a vacation to Disneyland Resort, Walt Disney World Resort, Disney Cruise Line, Disney Alani, Disneyland Paris, Ventures by Disney, Universal Studios Hollywood, Universal Studios Orlando, then I can do that for you. If you contact me and we can talk about all the different options and dates, and we can kind of even make recommendations on which days might be the best for you to go. And also as a complimentary, when you book with us, we will book your dining for you if you'd like, special events. And we also, when we book a vacation for you, we just don't say have a good time after we book it for you. We are there every step of the way. We contact you before your trip to make sure everything's squared away. We even have a checklist to make sure that you have everything you need. Reservations, dining, all these different things. Your transportation, if you need help with that from the airport. Any of those sort of things, we can help you with that too. We want to make the vacation the best it can be for you, because I know that vacations aren't cheap, and we can help you do that. So if you contact me, that's Lynn, and the email is lbarron@concierge.com. That's LBARRON at concierge.com. Or you can go to thesweepspot.com, and there's a link on our front page there. You can click on that, and there's information on how to contact me. But I'd love to talk to you and help you book the best vacation possible.
All curves and plastic. Monsanto's House of the Future is open to the public at Disneyland. The four-wing plastic shell makes a snug and solid five-room dwelling designed for a family of four. And coincidentally, it's a fairly typical family of four that gets first look. A family food center to store atomically irradiated food. A work surface that includes a combination supersonic dishwasher and storage unit. The kids' bathroom has a wash basin that adjusts to fit the height of the growing child. Throughout, the emphasis is on new uses of plastics in every area of family living, pioneering the use of features that may be standard in 10 years or so. A look at the future. Looks good, eh?
So, Dave, you have a new book that's coming out soon. It is out in through your publisher right now. But it's called The House of the Future, Walt Disney, MIT, and Monsanto's Vision of Tomorrow. And I wanted to ask you, how did this become a project for you, and what was your interest in this?
Well, first off, Lynn and Ken, thanks very much for having me on the podcast. And, you know, with all of my books that I've written, I pick topics that I'm passionate about, that I really want to do a deep dive in. And after I did my Claude Coates book and wrote extensively about Claude Coates helping Walt Disney build Disneyland and some of those seminal rides that he was, you know, the show designer on, or the, you know, the co-show designer or whatever, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time looking at material of, you know, from Disneyland, old photos and stuff. I had always been interested in the House of the Future. I was aware that it was an attraction at Disneyland. I knew it was only there for 10 years. It was put in before I was born, and it was taken out in 1967. You know, it was only there from 57 to 67, but it got, you know, it was demolished and removed in 67. And the first time I went to Disneyland was 1980, and that's because I grew up on the East Coast. So I wasn't fortunate enough to have Disneyland in my backyard like so many of my friends who grew up in Southern California. So I was really, you know, enamored by the design of it. I had read bits and pieces about it, but I decided I wanted to do the House of the Future purely for selfish reasons. I wanted to take a tour of the house. And if I couldn't physically walk through it, I wanted to try and create an immersive experience in a book that would hopefully leave people who didn't see it reasonably satisfied that they felt like they saw it, you know? And a portion of the book is actually laid out exactly how the tour would have taken if you walked through the house. And so that was really my motivation. I just wanted to feel like I saw the house and knew everything I could know about the house. And you know, within reason, obviously.
Yeah. A lot of people, let's just kind of talk a little bit about the basics of the house, just so some of our listeners might not be familiar with it. You said it had opened in 57. Why do you think they decided to even do this project?
Well, it really it's not a Disney project, so to speak, mm-hmm. like you would think of today with the Imagineers, you know, designing something. It actually was a project that was hatched by the Monsanto Plastics Division. And I think people have to realize that in the early 1950s, plastics and polymers were really kind of new. It was like a wonder material, and Monsanto's plastic division really wanted to try and expand their market share, if you will, of plastics, and so they commissioned MIT's architect and engineering school they funded a project for them to design a house that would use this new material, plastics, almost exclusively, and rethink the design of a home because they wanted to have plastics used in curvilinear structural supports and things like that. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, in the early 1950s, you know, World War II was 5 or 6 years behind. You had GIs who'd come back from the war. They were getting married. They were starting families. And there was this exodus out of city centers into the suburbs. And so you were having, you know, these the planned communities were being built. And so I think Monsanto was looking at that as a potential opportunity for their plastics and polymers. And so that's what they were looking at doing. They had no intention of selling the house. What they wanted to do was show off what you could do. You know, what were the possibilities? And then let architects and designers and industrial designers take it from there. And so they came up with that design, and Walt apparently saw it in 1956 at the plastics convention that was held in New York City at the New York Coliseum, and he already had a relationship with the CEO of Monsanto. They were friends. They knew each other. Monsanto was an early sponsor at Disneyland. They sponsored the Hall of Chemistry at the entrance to Tomorrowland. And so, you know, it seemed like a natural place to say, hey, you know, what if we put this in Disneyland? You know, and it was a free attraction. So there was no, you know, nobody had to use a ticket for it. And they could walk through and see all of these cutting edge, cool things that were not yet penetrating into households.
Yeah. As you point out, free, because, you know, what somebody who's kind of new to all of this might not, when I say new, I'm saying the last couple of decades. I mean, the A through E coupon system that eventually came aboard at Disneyland, you would pay a nominal fee for entrance, but you could also buy a ticket book that had A through E tickets. And there were some experiences that did not require a ticket. And this was one of them. So, I mean, now people just, you know, it seems so strange to people since they have the pay one price system where you know, you just pay for admittance to the park and it covers everything except, yeah. You know, you can do add-ons like, you know, Genie Plus or whatever. But yeah, so even, you know, it was possible for somebody to take their, you know, some kid could take his allowance, ride his bike over to Disneyland, pay to get, you know, just the entrance fee, and then there were certain things they could do for free, like, you know, go through the House of the Future, which was located where it's called Pixie Hollow, I think. Right. Now it's,
yes,
kind of there, when you're facing the entrance of Tomorrowland, it's to the left.
Yeah, and you know something, it's funny because I interviewed a few people. One of them was an attorney who grew up in Glendora, and he told me he remembers his parents taking him to Disneyland in 1961, and he was like 6 or 7 years old. And I said, "What'd you think of the House of the Future?" He goes, "I hated the House of the Future." I go, "Really? Why?" He goes, "Cause I just wanted to go on like the cool rides." He goes, "But he said my parents loved the House of the Future, and every time we went to Disneyland, my parents had to go through the House of the Future, and I had to go with them." You know, that was, I think, the standard reaction with a lot of kids. You know, yeah. But he said his mom was just really amazed and blown away by the Adams for Living kitchen that Kelvinator had put together. Kelvinator being a major appliance brand in the 1950s and has virtually disappeared now. I think they still make Kelvinator refrigerators in the Philippines. I found that out with some of my research, but at the time Kelvinator was as ubiquitous as General Electric, you know, or Sub-Zero or something like that, you know. And and that probably in 1957, I think the kitchen was probably the most futuristic, because everything was hidden, you know, with a touch of a button, you know, the microwave popped up out of the counter, and, you know, you had refrigeration compartments that dropped down underneath cabinets and things like that. They even had an area for irradiated food storage, you know. So, I mean, it's just like pretty wild stuff, you know.
And if the... if they're getting a drink of water out of a cup and it falls onto the floor, it doesn't shatter because it's not made of glass. It's made of plastic.
Yes.
And that's, I think, something that you brought up that it's just mind boggling today, because people have to imagine, you know, back then, if you went to the store and you wanted to get soda pop or, you know, Coke or whatever you called it, you know, it was in bottles.
Yeah, it was everything was glass bottles, or yeah, glass bottles or cans.
Glass, you know, glass. That was, and of course, glass can shatter, yeah. But plastic, it's a lot harder to shatter. So that was one of the selling points that Monsanto was pointing out to people, was that, oh look, you know, it you could, if it falls, it doesn't shatter.
Yeah, and that would actually come into play in 1967 when they tried to remove the house. We'll talk about that in a moment. Oh, yeah. But you know, the fact is that it was a natural place for it to go, because there was a lot of foot traffic at Disneyland, and there was an opportunity for all these different partner companies to put experimental products into the House of the Future. You know, Crane made the molded bathroom out of fiberglass. And, you know, out of that came the molded bathtub shower enclosure that they use in just about all new construction today. And also, you know, I think I mentioned it or used the analogy of the cruise lines, like the Disney cruise ships. If you've been on a cruise ship, the bathrooms are sort of molded and built as a unit that is dropped in, and they hook the utilities up to it. There were things like that. Safety glass was another thing that came out of the House of the Future that became widely used afterwards. The video phone, you know, the House of the Future had a you know, like a ring-like device at the front door, and you know, you could be in the bathroom and be able to see who was at the front door on a little video screen. And none of that stuff worked. It was like concept stuff, you know. You know, there's a couple of publicity photos in the book of, you know, the housewife of the future on the phone looking at a little video screen, and there's like, you know, slabs of meat, and the caption was, you know, she's talking to her butcher and picking out you know, cuts of meat that'll be delivered, you know. And you know, so there was a lot of that kind of forward thinking, and putting that into the House of the Future allowed all those different companies to ask the public what they thought, you know, to get opinions.
What was MIT's involvement?
So Monsanto actually funded the research for the architects and the civil engineers to actually come up with the design. And what's cool about the design of that house is that it has a footprint of 16 by 16. So it's a 16 by 16 foot footprint, which is the core foundation. And then the wings of the house are hanging off of that. And I go into great detail in explaining, you know, the construction and why it was constructed that way and how it works. But it's actually a really cool design from the standpoint that it would allow home building on a lot more different types of land that might not be feasible with regular construction, or might be more expensive with regular construction, you know?
So I could see that. I could see that, like, you know, hillsides, maybe wetland areas. But I'm thinking, you know, Californian here, earthquakes, you know, just think of how they could have adapted that, and how much easier it would have been to put that on rollers.
Yeah.
And you know, less of an issue in dealing with earthquakes. I mean, that would have, I mean, you can quibble about, you know, there's today we look at this and say, well, you know, it's better to build out of something renewable like wood than, you know, than plastics, but there's trade-offs. There's advantages. There's definite advantages to the House of the Future.
Absolutely. And you know, and I did point out in the epilogue of the book that, you know, I think it would be kind of cool if Disney actually built a couple of these down in Florida, maybe at the Contemporary Resort property or something.
Oh my gosh.
That would be a good idea. They'd allow families to stay in their own, you know, house. But build it with more sustainable materials. And I think with the advancement in different types of, you know, construction techniques, you could actually replicate those wings and maybe do it out of cold molded wood with epoxy, similar to how they build boats cold molded. You know, there's other ways of, you know, it would be really great to get some contemporary architects to take that design and to reconceive it with updated materials that maybe are more sustainable.
That would be great.
I think it would be a huge hit down at the parks, and the ability for people to stay in it, you know. I mean, look, let's face it, you know, people today, you know, when they travel, they're getting used to paying $400 and $500 a night. And certainly down at the resorts, they're charging that kind of money, you know, $300 to $500 a night for a room. And I think, you know, you could probably build one or two of those and command a pretty good price per night, but allow a family of four or six to sleep in there. I think it would be a really great experience. And that's really what the parks are all about, is going down for an experience, especially down at Disney World.
I could totally see somebody who visited the House of the Future as a kid, and now they've got, you know, now their grandparents, maybe great grandparents, you know, stuff like that, saying, hey, we're gonna go, when we go to Walt Disney World, we're gonna stay, you know, we're gonna stay in one. So I could totally see that.
And you know, by the way, it wasn't that big. You know, it was a little bigger than a you know, some of the wings were about maybe the same size as a cruise cabin, you know, on a Disney cruise ship. And I use that comparison in the text, but you know, all in all, I think, you know, it's like 1,300 square feet. It's
suburban, it's not huge. Family homes weren't all, you know, they've grown over the years,
yes,
on
yes.
average, but back then suburban family homes weren't very large,
right,
on average, you know. You had a lot of, you know, a lot of siblings shared rooms that, you know, it's less common today, but
yeah,
you know, if people are privileged enough to have a home, a house, you know, but it's, yeah, so back then that wouldn't have seemed oddly small, you know.
Yeah, no, but you know, I think by today's standards it is, but then again you look at it and you say, oh well, that could be a cool weekend place, you know. Maybe you got some little piece of property up in the mountains, or you know, out, you know, in a coastal area that's not really populated, you know, that'd be kind of a cool place to have, where you could, you know, spend a week or a weekend or whatever, you know. Maybe it's not a year-round living thing, but I just was enamored by the design because it was so different, you know. It's been described as like a cloud floating above, you know, the ground when you look at it. And they did a beautiful job with the, you know, Japanese inspired, you know, landscaping, when the house was in at Disneyland. And it did go, by the way, it did go through, several remodels during that 10-year period, but it was interior remodels where they updated furniture and they, you know, made it a little bit more colorful and, obviously contemporary, but, I had not read anything about any of the furniture that went into the place, and I took a particular interest in that, and I spent a lot of time researching and identifying the furniture designers for a number of the pieces that were in there, and you know, including the Eames chairs, which are still available and still being made today. The coconut lounge chair that was in the living room, I loved, and found out that Herman Miller still makes that chair. It's about $5,000, but they still make it, you know. Wow. And it's on my wish list someday, you know. And maybe if I turn in enough plastic bottles at the recycling center, I can get one, you know. But it's there's also a miniature chest that was in the family room, and that was also a George Nelson design. He was a well-known mid-century furniture designer who had been working at Herman Miller during that period. The swag leg desk that was in the family room, that was sort of a bill paying, you know, communication center for the house. That was another George Nelson design, and was made by Herman Miller, who still makes them. You know, they've updated some of it. They've added a little color to some things, but they still make some of these pieces. And it really is a testament to their, you know, the power of the design of them, and the fact that it's still around, you know, more than a half century later, 60 years later, you know.
I think the design also allowed for great use of sunlight.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was designed with the windows as like these wall windows on either side of each wing, every room in the house got a certain amount of sunshine during the day.
That's nice. All right.
It was a model, but did it have running water?
Yeah, it did. And it had a functioning, air conditioning and heating system. One of the requirements for the design, because all of the utilities for the house are in the core foundation under the house. So when they built that 16 foot by 16 foot core, which is hollow, all the utilities went in there. And it required that they have a body of water. That's why there was a pond put next to it, because the pond was used for the cooling system for the house, which was really cool. You know, they the crane air conditioning system also allowed the homeowner to put scent into the air. So you could put pine scent in or rose scent into the air through the central control panel. And there's some pictures of that in the book. And I kind of wondered, and actually I talked to Kevin Kidney about this. I wondered if it, like, you know, smelled the plastic when they first initially opened it, you know, and you know, like the way you would open some plastic toy and you get that kind of whiff of you know, that plastic smell.
Factory, you know, air.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, because they really were boasting, you know, they were boasting of the fact that the house had, you know, was basically made out of all man-made materials. Like, there was not a natural element in the house. Like, they were boasting that.
Yeah, that's what they boast about. Yeah.
and you know, and that played into the whole thing about, you know, pushing plastics out into the world. And by the way, I do have an author note at the very back of the book that I talk about the unintended consequences, because the unintended consequences of all that plastic from the 1950s forward is that it's gotten into our food chain. It's polluted our oceans. And so, you know, no one back in the 1950s, you know, there wasn't some evil person saying, let's put this out in the world and destroy the environment. Nobody knew that. Everybody was looking at it from an optimistic and exciting standpoint. They were enthusiastic about this incredible miracle material and all the things it could do to improve our lives, you know? And that's really what they were looking at. And I sort of feel like we're having that again. And I think, you know, every time there's new technology being introduced, you know, look what the internet has done to you know, just the divisiveness of the world, you know, with people putting out misinformation or bad, you know, nasty comments and stuff like that. But also look at what's happening with artificial intelligence, AI. You know, are we going to look back a half a century from now and go, oh my God, you know, we let this genie out of the bottle and it's done all this crazy stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, my feeling is I focus the book on the positiveness of this attraction, of this, you know, this free walkthrough that was put in at Disneyland that spoke to the optimism of the 1950s, you know, and you know, what the future would hold for us and all the exciting things that, you know, we had to look forward to. And that was really the focus of the book. But I felt compelled to put that little author note in at the back end,
Right.
Well, it fit right into Tomorrowland because at that time, like you had mentioned, there was a lot of exhibits. And I mean, they had the bathroom of the, you know, future bathroom of the, what was
yeah,
it?
Crane
bathroom of tomorrow.
Yeah. Crane. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, Tomorrowland was the lightest land, if you will. It was the sparsest land when they opened the park in 1955, and it was also, I think, the most difficult land to sort of stay on top of, because anytime you dreamt up what the future was going to be, by the time you got it built, it was present or it was past. It was not the future anymore. And I've said this before, one of the things I really like about Tomorrowland at Paris Disneyland is that it's this retro steampunk kind of H.G. Wells overlay of the future. And I think that was really cool for them to do that, because that's something that, you know, isn't going to be outdated. You know, it there's always a cool factor to it, you know, and but down at Disneyland in Anaheim, you know, it's all they can do to try and keep up with, you know, what is the future. You know, I almost feel like they should have, instead of building, you know, the Galaxy's Edge, you know, Star Tours area, they should have just made that Tomorrowland, you know.
Yeah. That would be one way of dealing.
I mean, they already had this. They already had the what is the Star Cruiser, Star Tours? Excuse me, Star Tours. Yeah. So anyway,
no, that's true. Yeah.
But you know, it was a popular attraction for its time, and some people said, why did they take it out in 1967? You know, why, you know, if it was popular, why did they take it out? And really, if you look at the history of Disneyland, you know, when Walt opened in 1955, he could not have opened without corporate sponsors and without leasing a lot of the space inside Disneyland to small businesses. So if you're a student of the park, you know that Main Street had a bra shop, had a china shop, Upjohn had a pharmacy, you know, Bank of America had a banking branch. You know, there were all of these like businesses that were in there that Disney didn't own. But 10 years into it, they were not renewing those leases and they were taking over those spaces, the, you know, themselves. And they were being less reliant on corporate sponsors. But what happened with the House of the Future was the Hall of Chemistry was closed. And in its place, they opened Adventure Through Inner Space, which was also sponsored by Monsanto. But at that point, Monsanto said, we don't want to keep paying for the upkeep of the House of the Future.
Right.
You know, and Disneyland said, well, you got to if you want to keep the house there. And they were like, well, take it out, you know, and that was, and then, you know,
easier
they were
said than done, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they were looking at potentially putting a restaurant facility into that space. And, but it, you know, they ultimately, just to talk about taking the house out, they ultimately closed it in 1967, and they budgeted one day to remove the house, and they brought in the wrecking ball on a crane. And they just thought, oh, we'll drop this a few times. It'll pulverize each of the wings, and then we'll just cart it off in trucks. And the wrecking ball actually bounced off of the fiberglass shell. And you have to realize those shells, the wings were called bents. So there was an upper bent and a lower bent that connected to the core. And the two bents connected together at the far end of the wing, sticking off the foundation. And those were made out of 32 layers of fiberglass. So it was 32 layers of fiberglass cloth and epoxy that made, you know, the mass. And so the wrecking ball literally bounced off without breaking or splintering or cracking or anything. And they wound up spending 5 days trying a bunch of different things. Ultimately, they used what are known as chain clamps that they wrap the chain around and then start to tighten it, and it crushes it. And so they broke it down into pieces. The interesting thing about it was that the steel bolts that held the fiberglass wing or bent to the foundation, the steel bolts broke before the fiberglass flange broke. Like the fiberglass flange didn't break, it was the steel bolts that broke. The other interesting thing about the house that I found out was that over the 10-year period, with all the temperature changes that we have in Southern California, because, you know, we got very cold, you know, 30s, 40 degrees at night during the winters, but then you could have a 50 degree or a 40 degree temperature change during the day, you know, where it might be 40 degrees in the morning and by midday it could be 80 degrees. And so you have these constant temperature changes. And then during the summers, you have these triple digit days. You have this house sitting in the sun, baking in the sun. That house settled only a little less than a quarter of an inch over the 10-year period that it was there, which I find really incredibly fascinating, because I think regular homes settle a little bit more than that, you know, over time. So they managed to get it all taken down in 5 days instead of the 1 day. And all those broken up, crushed fiberglass wings are in a landfill in Brea. So a thousand years from now, somebody might dig them up. What is this? Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's that was interesting that it when I in 1967 was, of course, you had the Carousel Progress debut adapted from the World's Fair. So while you couldn't walk through the House of the Future anymore, you were presumably getting a view of the future in the final act of Carousel of Progress.
Yes.
You know, you were kind of seeing, you know, the inside of a futuristic home. So the concept didn't completely leave Disneyland at that point, but it's not the same as walking through it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Carousel of Progress, you're an observer. You're sitting in an audience that's the entire audience rotates around a central stage, and you see the four acts taking you from the good old days into the future. But you know, with the House of the Future, you actually walked into it. You stood there. You were you know, immersed in it, so to speak. And I thought that was really cool. I would have loved to have seen it. I would have loved to have walked through it. And so with the book, I tried to make it as much of that experience. And by the way, I've gotten notes from people who got the, you know, the folks who got their author signed copies early. I've gotten several notes from people who really were thrilled and felt like, you know, one person felt like, you know, it had brought back a lot of memories because they had actually gone through the house. But somebody else said, you know, I too didn't go through the house. I missed it. But I really feel like I saw it now because of your book, you know, and that's really the kind of response I was hoping to get from people.
Yeah, I've seen really good responses. So what was that? What were you going to say, Lynn?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm glad you mentioned your book. I wanted to talk a little bit about how it came about, how long it took you, and there's photos inside.
Yeah, I mean, it's chock full of photos. I mean, I don't think anybody's really done that much of a deep dive. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, a deep dive on an attraction. I mean, there's some on Pirates and some on Haunted Mansion, but not to the extent that I've done it on the House of the Future. And and it took me a good 2 years to do this book, and there was a lot of research involved. There was a lot of sourcing of material, not only from the Monsanto archives, but from the MIT archives, private collections, you know, material that was already out there, kind of scattershot interviews and things like that with some of the old timers who worked on it, and digging out all of that material so you could actually get some quotes and construct a story that was not only a linear story, but a comprehensive story.
Well, I can't wait to get my coffee.
Well, let me just tell you, and I'll let your audience know this. If they want to get a signed copy, they can go to theoldmillpress.com. If they buy the book there, they can use the code FRIEND5, FRIEND 5, all capital letters and the number 5. And they can save $5 off of it. And it'll be an author signed copy, and there's always a few extra goodies that come with it. Or they can go online. There's retail partners. If you go to my website, davidbossert.com, and go onto the books tab and click on the House of the Future book. There's links to Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million. So, I mean, it'll be available and it ships next Tuesday from all of those retailers. But if they, you know, if they wanted to get it now, and I don't know when this is dropping, but getting an author signed copy by me, yours truly, the author, just use the code FRIEND5 at theoldmillpress.com.
Great. I just wanted to touch a little bit on this. It's not, you have another book out that's out around this time also.
Yes. Right? I have Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas Visual Companion, which essentially is a making of the whole movie. It's a behind the scenes of how the movie got made and through the entire process of the filmmaking process. It talks and does a deep dive into story, art direction, puppet fabrication, animation, special effects, set design, set building, you know, and then the afterlife of the movie, which is, you know, just it's got a bigger fan base now than it's ever had. 30 years on, you know, they do the overlay at Disneyland on the Haunted Mansion. You know, there's people with tattoos of the characters all over their bodies. I actually have a 2-page spread of fan tattoos that I was able to get, and another 2-page spread on fan art. Talk about the live concerts. They're doing Nightmare Before Christmas at the Hollywood Bowl on the 27th, 28th, and 29th this year in a couple of weeks. You know, it just goes on and on. So, yeah, so much merchandise. And there's always new stuff coming out every year.
Well, so, and the, of course, the after hours party that the resort does now is called the Oogie Boogie Bash.
In California Boogie. Adventure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oogie Boogie being from the movie.
Yep. Yep.
And I've, you know, every year when I see that the Haunted Mansion has to go down twice a year for the install and the disinstall or the removal, I always think, you know, I mean, at the time I thought this movie should have its own attraction. You know, at the time I really dug the movie at the time it came out. I mean, I know it's been kind of a slow burn for some people who, you know, it wasn't a blockbuster, I don't think, when it came out, but it certainly has staying power.
It wasn't a blockbuster when it came out because it Disney really didn't know what to do with the movie.
Right.
They didn't really know how to market it, and they didn't want to put the Disney name on it because they thought it was going to alienate their core audience at the time. So they put the Touchstone name on it, and that's since been stripped off of it, and it's now Disney Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. I mean, we could do a whole episode with you guys just on that one book. But that released on September 26th, and it's gone out in the world. It was a bestseller on Amazon, I think, for the first four or five days that it was available. It's out there, and it's getting a great response, which is really nice.
Yeah,
good. I'm glad. That's you keep putting out these great books. If somebody goes to it's oldmillpress.com.
Yeah, if you go to the oldmillpress.com, they have a bunch of my books that are that you can get author signed copies on. If you go to davidbossert.com and hit the books tab, you'll see all of my books there. I think, you know, I've lost count, which is crazy, but like half the books I've written were published by Disney Publishing, and I've got now other books that are out through the Old Mill Press, and it's just crazy. you know? And I mean, who would have thought? But I just go from one project to the next and I'm just having a ball. And I think that's part, and that's really part of it, is that, you know, it's not a job for me. It's a passion, and it's something that excites me. And I like telling these stories, and I'm picking topics that haven't really been touched. You know, like my Kem Weber book on the animation furniture, you know, Kem Weber Mid-Century Designs for the Disney Studios is all about the furniture that was designed for the animation department. you know, nobody wrote anything about that. To me, it was a love letter to the furniture. Yeah. And as I'm talking to you guys, I'm sitting at a 1939 Kem Weber animation desk that the studio gave me when I left.
Wow. Oh, my.
So, you know. Cool. It's these kinds of things that I think are worth preserving and telling the story about, and you know, leaving those for posterity, you know, especially, you know, things that are disappearing, you know, like the animation furniture and the House of the Future, and, you know, these things. You know, nobody had written a book on Claude Coates, and I was fortunate to have known Claude. You know, I met him when I was just starting out in my career, and he was in the twilight of his career. And, you know, the accomplishments. And, you know, the amazing thing about that book was that some people felt like, well, nobody knows who Claude Coates is. Well, yeah, we got to write a book to tell them who Claude Coates is. But if you talk to the fans, the fans are like, oh, yeah, he's got two windows on Main Street. And, you know, didn't he do Pirates? Or, you know, they know who he is. Or I had somebody say, oh, God, I love his backgrounds in the animation, you know, the Geppetto's Workshop in Pinocchio, you know. The fans know who some of these people are, and Claude certainly deserved the book, and not just being relegated to a chapter in a book on Imagineers or something, you know. And I proved that by the book that I wrote, because it's a 50,000 plus word manuscript on Claude Coates's portion of his career. It's just the 15 years that his first 15 years as an Imagineer. I mean, you could do a whole book on the 20 years he spent as a background painter and color stylist at the animation studio. And then you could do a third book on, you know, the remainder of his career at Walt Disney World, Paris, and Tokyo. You know, so it's just, you know, and I've said this before to other people. There's thousands of stories in the Disney universe that still haven't been told. And I'm just looking around for those really compelling stories that I think there's going to be an audience for. And so far there have been.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it. You do a very good job.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, we know, we know how hard it was to put together our books, which are, you know, the second one has some photographs, but it's nothing like, you know, the stuff you're doing with these, which, you know, these things necessitate some good photographs because of the subject matter, and just amazing books to see. So, you know, and like you said, documenting stuff that other people haven't documented, or, you know, stuff that's going away, disappearing. And so that's really good, because you're preserving it in a way that, you know, we'll have it on our bookshelves, we'll have it on our nightstands, we can thumb through these things on our coffee tables, and it preserves these, you know, whether we got to personally experience some of these things or not. Like, you know, of course the House of Future, that, you know, Lynn and I came around after that was gone. You know, but now we get to get an in-depth look at it, you know, as and of course for other people it's memories of something they actually experienced.
Absolutely, without question. And you know, I think we're all fans of Disney and the parks and stuff like that, so it's like there's a hunger to know more. And you know, for me with writing books, there's a hunger to just document some of this stuff. And some of these things, you know, nobody's going to do a book on, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, Disney may look at it and go, oh, well, you know, we can't sell 100,000 units. So, I mean, it's not worth doing, you know, and I'm not looking at it that way. I'm looking at it from the standpoint of, just, you know, documenting something and leaving a record of it.
Well, we'll have to continue our conversation about Nightmare before Christmas for sure someday soon. But thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, Lynn and Ken, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me back. I always enjoy talking with you guys. And once again, I just say to everybody, if you're interested in the House of the Future, go to theoldmillpress.com, and use your code FRIEND5 and save $5 and get yourself a signed copy of the book. And also just check out my personal website at davidbossert.com. Thanks, guys.
What an episode, Ken.
Yeah, we actually got into talking about two books, didn't we?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
You know, even though we have our own books to promote, we love having other authors on. Your library should have our books and their books, and you want a healthy Disney library in your home. But yeah, that you know, I love doing these episodes this way, where we alternate, you know, because we have a main topic episode just like this was, and then alternate episodes that come out, you know, a week later are current events at the resort, so that we catch you up on what's been happening lately at the Disneyland Resort. So if you're planning a trip, you know somebody who is, especially direct them that way to those episodes. And, you know, we covered history or a single topic or whatever on these episodes that we're doing, the main topic episode. So thank you for following us wherever you like to listen. Subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And Lynn, do we have any reviews this time?
We don't, but we need some. So if you've been listening to this show for more than one episode and you enjoy it, go on over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave a review, and we'll read it on our next episode.
Yes, please do. That really helps out.
Yeah, and also go to our website. We have a lot of good stuff over there. You can get links to our T-shirts, our books, as we mentioned, and show notes for each episode. So go on over there and check that out. But thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.